Warming temps and heavy rains can spell trouble for your home. Don't wait for a problem. Get a free foundation inspection from PermaSeal. Stay dry, stay protected. For peace of mind, call 800-421-SEAL or visit permaseal.net.
We are talking to Mike Leonard. He's a nationally recognized superstar trial lawyer, handles federal and state criminal appeal matters in addition to business, employment, and injury cases. Speaking of winning, he is believed to be the only practicing attorney to have attained at least six or more complete not guilty jury verdicts on all counts and charges in favor of his clients in a federal criminal prosecutions here in Chicago. He's an adjunct professor at the prestigious Northwestern Pritzker School of Law. Welcome to the show. You're a friend of WGN. I listen to you all the time on John Hansen. Welcome again.
Thanks, Karen. Appreciate it. I listen to you all the time, too. I mean, and I don't hold against you your affiliation with Patrick Dolan, my arch rival on WGN.
Yeah, he is an arch rival. You guys butt heads all the time, but that's okay, because then it's just he's in a better mood when he gets to work on Monday.
It's all in good spirits. We just had our Christmas battle of the Home Alone trial, so I'm still bitter about that.
That was amazing. That was really, really well done. Okay, let's talk about a real case instead of that fantasy stuff right now. Let's talk about the Michael Madigan, former House Speaker, who February, a jury convicted him on a partial verdict. It wasn't a full win. Some of the counts the jury could not reach a consensus on. Some were not guilty and some were guilty. So this week, his lawyers filed post-trial motions. Can you tell our listeners just a little bit of background on what a post-trial motion is, what the main arguments were just generally for Mike Madigan, and then what happens next?
Yeah, so in federal court, you have a chance after the trial's over to get the judge to revisit rulings and try to reverse the jury's verdict, essentially. So as you can probably imagine, you're successful extremely rarely, right? You probably 98-99% of the time, the court's going to uphold all the rulings from the trial and pretrial, because you're basically asking the court to say that they did something wrong. Either they excluded evidence they shouldn't have, they admitted evidence that they shouldn't have, the sufficiency of evidence wasn't enough to convict, or sometimes you'll have a jury instruction issue. So they've raised a whole bunch of them, and I don't know if you want to talk about generally some of them.
You know, not particularly, but I do want to ask you this question. Because the jury came back, and some of the jurors did speak to the media, and you got the sense that they thought maybe that the case was overcharged, and even the verdict wasn't a slam dunk, which they usually are. I mean, most of these cases, maybe not recently, but in the past, they have been all guilty on all counts. This was a real splintered verdict. Do you think the judge looks at that splintered verdict, looks at how the jury was really, you could tell that they were thinking about it and they had questions. Is that going to change the way the judge views the post-trial motions?
I don't think so. I mean, again, because primarily you're asking the judge to find that he made a mistake of law. And so I don't think that he will find that the sufficiency of the evidence argument is going to fly. That's really probably an issue for the Seventh Circuit to decide. So they do, I believe, have some great issues for appeal, including there was a big battle during deliberations about a jury instruction, which I think the court somewhat conceded hadn't been maybe properly given or properly phrased. And so I think that's going to be a big subject of the appeal. And there are a couple real huge issues about whether certain tapes should have ever been heard by the jury. So, you know, certainly I think the appellate court, if you're the defense counsel, you want them to see that this is really a mixed thing. This wasn't certain. This was no dead man winger. I think it really helps you from a defense standpoint, at least on appeal.
So let's talk about what's next. It looks like June 9th is the date the judge is going to rule on these post-trial motions. And then sentencing is set just a few days later on June 13th. First question is, if obviously Madigan is going to appeal to the Seventh Circuit, which is our federal appeals court, will he, if he's sentenced, which we know he probably will he be incarcerated pending appeal, or will that incarceration be stayed until after the appeal is ruled upon?
Yeah, real good question. So normally after you're sentenced, within about 90 days, you have to report. But clearly the defense counsel in this case is going to make a motion to the Seventh Circuit and say, look, his surrender date should be stayed because we have these serious and substantial legal issues that we have a good chance of winning on, and therefore try to get a stay of his surrender date, which I think is quite possible.
And I would think that his 82-year age might have something to do with that as well, because, you know, if he gets a substantial sentence and starts serving it, I mean, he's getting up there.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, his age is going to be a factor in the sentence he gets, you know, just like any defendant, that would be relevant. But I think it would be also relevant to the Seventh Circuit, you know, at 83, if he starts serving time that they have any doubts about whether he should be serving, I think that'd be a big factor in his favor.
Let's talk about the issue of forfeiture, and a lot of that doesn't get a lot of play and a lot of press. But could you explain to our listeners what forfeiture is?
Sure. So basically, it's the concept of the government seeking essentially a monetary penalty to claw back the money that really is the ill-gotten gains from the crime. So in this case, the government is claiming there's about $3 million that's at issue that never should have been paid out by ComEd, et cetera, for these bogus contractors. So my understanding is that $1.5 million of Madigan's campaign money could be used to satisfy the restitution, which would still leave a gap, but it sounds like he'd have the ability to pay that gap. But certainly he can go into his campaign coffers and pay a substantial portion of the restitution.
One last question before we take a break here, and that is, you know, you've defended these types of cases. Do you have any opinion as to whether the U.S. attorney overcharges these political corruption cases? And secondarily, are the laws, do you believe the laws between what's bribery and what's lobbying, do you think they're clear enough for the public to know what is what?
Yes, 100% they overcharge. That's an intentional practice. And of course, if you're the government and you have 23 counts, you have a good feeling that, gee, maybe we can get the jury to go with us on some of them. And they always overcharge as a practice, in my view. And maybe I'm a little biased as a federal criminal defense lawyer. And then, I'm sorry, what was the second part, Karen?
Well, you know, do you think the laws are clear enough? Because, you know, I ask this question of so many guests. Why do we have a continuation of every, you know, these politicians crossing the line, going to jail? How many governors? How many aldermen? I mean, are the laws clear enough? Is that a problem, or is it a problem with something else altogether?
I think it's a huge problem. And as you probably know, there's been recent Supreme Court and Seventh Circuit cases which really call this whole thing into question. You know, the idea now from the U.S. Supreme Court that the politician has to know and agree upon in advance, you know, what's going to happen as a result of the alleged improper influence or bribe. So I think the law is very unclear, and the jury instructions are crafted in such a way, and the law is crafted in such a way that's very confusing to a jury. And I think we can all agree from a sort of ethical standpoint what should be done. But I think federal law is far from clear on these issues.
Yeah, I'd like to see the legislature really get to it and make it so clear that there aren't these areas that can be argued on appeal even. I mean, you know, if people are going to go to prison on these things, you want to make sure it's done correctly. We're talking to Mike Leonard. How can people reach you, Mike?
Karen, 312-380-6559, LeonardTrialLawyers.com.
We're talking to nationally recognized superstar trial attorney Mike Leonard. We're talking about some of the news of the week. And Mike, I wanted to address the issue of a third term for our President Trump. He made some comments, and he's made some comments in the past, that he is considering running for a third term. Can you tell our listeners and explain what our Constitution says about this issue?
Yeah, what an interesting issue. So the 22nd Amendment to the United States Constitution says that you can't be elected more than twice to the presidency. So most people would say it's very clear that he can't. However, these hypotheticals people have come up with include, could he be the vice president and then the president resigns and he becomes the president because he's not elected to the office? So, and then a similar argument has been made, what if he were Speaker of the House of the House of Representatives, and then those above him resigned or lost their offices? He wouldn't be elected. He would succeed to the presidency. So there's these hypothetical scenarios, which I'm not sure will ever happen, but a clear, you know, law on its face, the Constitution would say you can't be elected more than twice.
Interesting. Let's go to the civil suit in the Highland Park shooting case. As we followed this case for years, the defendant pled guilty a couple months ago, and that case is over for now. But there was a civil suit that was filed against some of the gun dealers where the defendant purchased his gun. Can you, Mike, tell us a little bit about this lawsuit and what the allegations are?
Yeah, so the case is brought on behalf of the families of those who were killed and also people who were injured or suffered trauma from that event. And basically, they sued the manufacturers, which is, I guess, Smith & Wesson, and then a couple of firearms dealers that sold the guns. And the way they're crafting the case, it's kind of similar to the Connecticut Newtown case, where they were able to successfully sue the manufacturer Remington. And the way this works is there's a federal law that generally prohibits these types of suits. However, it gives certain exceptions. And one is if the gun manufacturer is violating a state law that deals with, you know, consumer protections. So the legal theory here is that they were marketing the guns in violation of Illinois law by targeting them towards teenagers and marketing things that are criminal. So, you know, all that's happened so far is they've survived, the plaintiffs have survived a motion to dismiss in the Circuit Court of Lake County. So the case will go forward. They'll get to fully litigate it, take depositions, get documents, get into the marketing strategy and how they were marketing towards, you know, young people and minors and 18-year-olds, et cetera, and how they were using guns in games and things like that. And, you know, ultimately, you could see a great possibility that the case might settle, just like the Newtown, Connecticut did for a large number.
Interesting. And I assume that the families are getting some satisfaction out of this, because when these horrible things happen, you know, I mean, it's hard to even put yourself in their shoes, but, you know, they want to have change. You know, they want to hold people accountable. They want to see that their loved one didn't die in vain. And if there is some sort of change or some sort of ramification, I assume that that's going to be very much of comfort to them. But anyway, so we'll keep a close eye on that one. So what is going on in Mike Leonard land? Are you trying cases in the next few months? And tell me what you're working on right now.
Yeah, a whole bunch of them. It's going to be a good year for trials. We actually have a murder trial starting tomorrow in state court. And then in the next month, I guess in May, we have a couple federal cases that are going. So it should be a busy year with a trial like every month or two. So really looking forward to that. That's what we most enjoy doing.
When you have a murder trial, Mike, this, I assume that's in state court?
Yeah, that's at 26 in California.
So in a case like that, you know, do you have a lot of forensic evidence, and do you have experts that you retain to testify? Is that a big part of your practice?
Yeah, definitely. You know, you definitely are retaining experts where it's relevant to your case. It's kind of an interesting case we have going because there is very little on the forensic side in this case. So, you know, the state will be putting very little forward from a forensic standpoint, and really, in my view, putting on a kind of a weak, you know, semi-identification witness who really didn't see what happened. So it's going to be interesting. So it doesn't this case itself doesn't lend itself to a lot of experts, but yeah, most murder cases do, because you have all sorts of issues like prints, DNA, all, you know, identification experts, all sorts of stuff. But we don't want to have a lot of that in this case.
And do you find that recently juries really want that kind of evidence? I mean, I've heard over and over again that, you know, jurors watch the shows and they watch CSI, and they want and they expect to have forensic evidence. And if not, you know, some sort of video camera evidence.
Yeah, I think it definitely is a benefit to the defense if there's an absence of, you know, the forensic stuff that people are accustomed to seeing. I mean, jurors are, you know, so attuned to true crime stories, podcasts, serial podcasts, the things on TV like Dateline. So I think their expectation for actual forensic and physical evidence and expert testimony to support the prosecution's theory is probably at an all-time high. And certainly when there's an absence of that, it definitely plays in the hands of the defense and defense counsel.
Do you ever use jury consultants in your work?
We really haven't, I have to admit. I mean, we've done some real informal things. So, you know, there's a lot of ways you can do it. You can spend an awful lot of money. and get a consultant and have mock jury panels and things of that nature. We've done mock panels of our own making where we bring people in and either, you know, give them a truncated version of the case or, you know, have your client testify, things of that nature, and get their feedback. But I haven't done the full-blown, you know, $100,000 job where they're advising you beforehand and then sitting there during jury selection. That's not something we have done generally.
Yeah, it's interesting. Some people swear by that process, and some people think, hey, you know what, if I'm going to be making an argument to the jury, I want to pick them. I want to look them in the eye. I have a good instinct about who is fair and who's not going to be fair to my client, but I just wanted to hear from the horse's mouth. Mike Leonard, thank you so much for being on our show, and can you give our listeners some contact information for you?
Sure. Thanks again for having me, Karen. Really appreciate it. I love listening to your show, and I'm at 312-380-6559, LeonardTrialLawyers.com. Thanks a lot.